Let's all give a warm welcome to our speaker, Jerry.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Hannah. My name is Jerry. I'm a compulsive overeater, sugar addict, restrictor, exercise bulimic. What else? Compulsive food behaviors. Oh, and a binger. That's a big one. So I am really delighted to be here. I've heard a lot about this meeting. The last time I came here, actually, I saw the video on Roseanne, which was wonderful. And it's just interesting hearing her story and how she persevered and created what we're doing today through a lot of trial and tribulations, kind of like my experience with recovery. So let's see. What was I like? What happened? And what am I like now? Well, what I was like, I think I was constantly hiding. I mean, growing up, my parents were both rageaholics and physically abusive. So I tried to stay somewhat inconspicuous from the standpoint I didn't want to be severely punished or severely criticized. It didn't work a lot of the times, but so I kind of learned this thing about hiding, to not reveal my authentic, vulnerable self. I'm still working on that. I'm going to be 79 in July. And I first came to OA in 1987. And I think someone in New York has probably heard a lot of my story, but that 1987 meeting in March was the only meeting I went to that year. So I bring what I was like was a lot of arrogance, a lot of ego. And I even remember I went in the insurance business and had a lot of ups and downs, but there are times I really did very well with it. Started in Philadelphia and then to Syracuse and then in New York and take over a Fifth Avenue agency for a major insurance company. And I was just really fearful. I mean, it wasn't going well. And, you know, I wasn't a drinker. So the way I dealt with stress, and because I didn't know it, but I could not very well handle my feelings and the sensations of my body, mostly from the stresses of work, but not exclusively. And I was a workaholic. So when the weekends came and I wasn't as busy with work, I had to experience my feelings. Now, I didn't know that was going on. So my feelings largely seemed intolerable. So what I would do is I would always kid myself. I'd start eating, usually on a Friday night, junk food and ice cream and sugary stuff. I'm a sugar addict. And I would often gain somewhere between 5 and 8 pounds on a weekend. And because I was fairly athletic and busy during the week with work, and I was a runner for a large portion of my early, that part of my life, I would lose it during the week. And then there was a guy by the name of Jim Fix who wrote a book about running many years ago. And he talked about, and he'd give lectures, how he could eat all this junk food and candy and stuff because he was a runner and keep his weight off. So it kind of gave me license to do what I was doing. Now, he died of a heart attack while he was running. I didn't know that I was doing anything crazy, to tell you the truth, because I had custom-made suits. Wasn't particularly overweight, but when I say that, back then I think I was maybe 5'9", 171 pounds. And I was, you know, I was working out. And now I never, ever, I mean, my civilian friends have all tended to gain weight at my age pretty much. But I'm like, I weigh myself once a month. I got that from one of our OA pamphlets. I'm actually like about 138, 5'8". I lost 3/4 of an inch in this being less young. And it has not been a diet. I just, when I stopped the binging, I stopped the sugar and the junk food and exercise moderately and regularly. The weight just poured off me. And over a period of the 36 years in the program, to include three major relapses, my plan of eating just organically got healthier. I mean, back in the day, I used to think if I was like 155, that would be ideal. So it's strange. I do get, you know, people talk about being fat shamed. I get sometimes thin shamed when people that I know, I haven't seen me in a long time. And they'll say, you know, are you okay? Something going on with you? And yet the doctors give me pretty good reports. They give me great reports, actually. So, you know, it's a, you know, physical, emotional, and spiritual recovery. So my weight has been stable for quite a while. And these relapses that I mentioned, you know, I only came to one meeting the first year. But somehow the power of these meetings, the seed was planted. And even at that first meeting, it was in New York City, and the meeting was really crowded. It was at a church, and there weren't enough seats, and people were sitting all over the floor. And again, I showed up in my corporate suit and my Hermes tie, and I'm hiding in the corner. And I heard some guy at that first meeting talk about how he's going to call someone and tell them what they were going to eat. That just seemed beyond my comprehension, anything I could ever consider doing or would be willing to do or want to do. So I didn't come back from a year. I thought I could, I didn't think. I was convinced I should be able to handle this all by myself. I mean, my father would give me messages like, you can do anything you put your mind to. And then next breath, he would call me a stupid idiot that's not going to amount to anything. And my mother kind of gave me the impression, if you're really going to be a man, then you really don't need other people. You can be a strong, independent person. I found out both were myths. I could not stop compulsively overeating without other people in this program. And it had nothing to do with my motivation, my attitude, how much pressure I put on myself, how much determination I had, that I really needed a spiritual solution. And that was kind of a challenge, because I went through this period where I was an agnostic, and I was an atheist, then an agnostic. And when I was in the military, I had no preference on my dog tags. I was raised Jewish, and bar mitzvah, I think what I got from that, if I didn't go to Hebrew school, I was going to get my ass kicked. And I never quite got the spiritual connection. So I got involved in this other program outside of OA, spiritual program, mind, body, and identity. Spirit, mind, body, and identity. And I would tell them that I was having these incredible binges. So they would give me like a spiritual treatment. And then I'd come back the next week and I say, I did it again. They give me another treatment. So I think this is true. I don't totally remember, because, you know, I didn't have cell phones in those days. I didn't have a computer. We didn't have literature other than a couple of the AA materials. And I called information, and I said, I know there's an AA for people that drink. Is there something for people that have trouble with food and overeating? So she said, yeah, there's an Overeaters Anonymous. She gave me a phone number, and I called it. And in those days, to get a meeting, I had to listen to the entire recording as it went through all the meetings in New York. So if I missed it, you would have to listen to the recording all over again. But anyway, that's how I found the meeting. So the power of these meetings, the seed was planted. I was at a business meeting in Hartford, and they were talking about how they were going to alter our contract, meaning less money. And there was a bowl of, can I talk about food here? Food, yes. There was a bowl of honey-coated cashews in the middle of the table. And I had been on, I don't know, it wasn't a diet per se, but I was a chocoholic. So I was drinking these chocolate milkshakes. And I actually was maintaining my weight at that point. And I remember, I was feeling the stress of what they were talking about. So I said, let me just take a handful of these honey-coated cashews. And I, you know, proceeded to get through the bowl. So then I started binging like crazy again. So I remembered that meeting. I said, well, let me go to a meeting. I went to another meeting in New York. That night, I'm pretty sure I binged on a pint of ice cream and the rest of it. But I was always kidding myself. I would have like a gentlemanly scoop, whatever that is, in a bowl, put the container back in the freezer. And before I know it, it was at the bottom of the container, and I didn't even know what happened. And I would do that over and over again. So anyway, I think I binged that first night. And then the next day I went to a meeting, and the woman leading the meeting, I asked her if she would sponsor me. So she said, yeah, call me at 6:30 in the morning. And that's the only time I would have been able to, would have been willing to do that. She ran a magazine. And I called her the next morning to turn over a plan of eating. And it seems kind of simple now, but I left, she wasn't there. I left her a message. I could not get clear as to what I was going to eat. And I thought that was such a simple assignment. And I did speak to her the next day, and she kind of in a diplomatic way said, what was that? And it took me about 2 weeks to get even clearer as to what I was going to eat on a plan of eating. And then she was walking out of the meeting. This is even before I got the sponsor, that one first meeting. And she said, man, you need a sponsor. And then I think she walked me to like a Woolworth type store to buy a little black book. She said, it'd be a good idea if you could get 6 names at each meeting of people that you can call as a resource. I still have that little black book. So then I started going to meetings, and I went to meetings. I didn't know about a 90 and 90, but I think I went every day. I was just afraid of this insatiable urge. And I got abstinent. I started working the steps. I had 2 sponsors. I had a food sponsor, and I had a step sponsor. And the step sponsor, he was an AA guy, but in OA. And I would meet once a week, and we'd go through the AA 12 and 12 and the big book and work the steps. And again, I still can't tell you after all these years how that happened, that suddenly, as a result of doing that, it wasn't that easy in the beginning, but after a couple of weeks, that imperious urge to compulsively overeat and eat the junk, it dissipated, especially as a result of going to a meeting every day and having a sponsor and working the steps, and then ultimately sponsoring people, taking them through the steps, ultimately doing service and leading meetings and so on, volunteering for service positions, calling newcomers. I was doing quite a bit of reading of the literature. And, you know, the magic of the AA people, they found that they, and we had only pay phones in those days, but if they walked around with nickels and dimes, and they felt like having a drink, and, you know, they get to a pay phone and make a phone call. So I kind of got this idea from reading a lot of the literature that the people that were absent and these guys in AA that started it, they found out that when they helped one another and they reached out to other people that were having trouble with drinking, that they no longer had to drink one day at a time. So that was my experience. So then I got really, I guess I was in OA for, I was 9 years. My first absence was 9 years. And I didn't go to meetings for the last 4 years of that. But what I did do is I had memorized the 12 steps. So I would say the 12 steps to myself. But, you know, the day came where, and I didn't think I needed meetings anymore. Again, East got out. I call the disease that my ego is the disease. So the day came where I said, you know what? I can now have ice cream. So I pulled out the pint from the freezer, put a scoop in a dish, put it back in the freezer. I was okay for a couple of days, maybe even a week. I don't remember. And then before I knew it, I was binging like I had never even heard of OA. So, it was so bad. You know, I ran an office, probably had 100 people in it. I was hungover on the weekends from all this binging. And I couldn't get out of bed often. I remember on a Monday morning, and the shades were drawn. And if I could barely make it to the bathroom, because my moods were terrible, felt depressed, I felt guilty, shame. I look in the mirror, and I just had dead eyes looking back at me. You know, the phone was ringing, people wondering where the hell I am. You know, it was horrible. So I think I was out for maybe 6 months or so. And then again, I remembered the meetings because I was miserable. And the eating was worse than I had ever remembered. I was busting out of my custom-made shirts. I split my pants one time going to a convention. Anyway, I went back to another meeting. I remember what worked: go to meetings, get a sponsor, worth the steps. And that's pretty much what I did. I got absent again. I was absent for 1 year. What I did was, I'm a slow learner. I decided I could have a bowl of ice cream. And I repeated that whole scenario where I was out for 6 months to a year from the ice cream. Went back to meetings, got abstinent. I did it again, and then I had another year. The arrogance and all that stuff. I came back again, full of shame and guilt, pulled back into a meeting. Now, it wasn't that easy. I mean, it was probably like, I never really was on a diet. Probably say, you know, on Monday, I'm going to start a diet. I would say on Monday, I'm going to go to a meeting. And that went on for a couple of months. And finally, I showed up. I recognized a couple of people. And what intrigued me was that the OA meetings had evolved. The format was just a little bit different, you know, from having business meetings. There was much more literature. You know, people were reaching out and made me feel welcome. I started to relax in that meeting, like I had somehow come back to home. And I, And that time, and this continues, I think I'm 21 years, 9 months, and 9 days, current absence. But I know that I'm a bite away. Thank you for that. I'm a bite away. Why? Because I did some research over the years, and that first bite, that's the one I have no control over. And one of the visuals that I had that I'll share with you is I went to a rehab actually for codependency, 28 days at Sierra Tucson. And we used the 12 steps. And one of the sculptures they did, like we're in a room, they said, imagine the disease, whatever it is, compulsive overeating, betting, drugging, alcohol, sex, and the disease is up in the corner. And I'm completely helpless by myself with that disease next to me. But if I take a person and it represents step one, and I put that person in between the disease, I begin to have some protection that I don't have all by myself. And then I take another person and I take step two. So I get 12 people in the 12 steps between me and the disease. Then I take the traditions and each person representing a tradition between me and the disease. And then I take the concepts and line up a bunch of people in these sculptures to represent the concepts. And somehow that visualization stuck with me that by myself, I'm defenseless. I'm defenseless against the first bite. I put a lot of stock in looking good. Like I said, I was exercising, I was athletic. I made a lot of money when I was younger, kind of peaked early. And so all those, I had a big apartment. So all those external things led me to believe that I wasn't like you guys. And somehow I was better, superior. In my little world, everybody was either less than or more than. Where in a way I kept hearing we were all equal. It didn't matter if you only had one token or you were wealthy. It just didn't matter. The disease was the equalizer. And besides that, every human being deserves respect. And I learned that, through the 12 steps. And my big problems, two of them, love and God, my two biggest issues, loving myself and others, and, having a connection with a higher power. So the 12 steps are all about that. Bill W's book, The Language of the Heart, he talks about the 12 steps are all about learning to love ourselves, the traditions, the learning how to love others, and the concepts, learning how to love the world. So, I just came in OA, just wanted to stop binging and get on with my life, and I didn't expect to ever see you guys again. Wrong again. So this program has been all about love. I go through all these rituals in the morning. I don't really tell anybody, maybe a sponsee here and there. I'll look in the mirror and kind of focus and try to see the spirit, see God inside myself and through my pupils, knowing I'm a spiritual being, I believe, having a spiritual experience in a human body, living in a universe governed by spiritual laws. Now, a lot of times I have all these slogans and I don't believe it, but I keep saying them. And I think they start to penetrate after a while. And I look in the mirror and I say, Jerry, that I love you and totally accept you without conditions, no modifications required, not based on what I've done, what I didn't do, what I'll do and what I don't do, just being a spirit of God, a child of God. So I go through that little ritual. The whole thing probably takes 30 seconds. And again, over a period, I don't tell anybody about it other than you guys, but it's helped me. So this is interesting. I mentioned I'm going to be 79 in July. So I was telling one of my sponsees that I had this extraordinary experience in the 2005. There was a period where I was trying different religious groups to see spiritual groups where I could find a home. And I showed up at this place in New York, 2005. And the minister, I don't remember what anything else he said, but he said, you know, you have a dream and it's not going to let you alone. It's always been there. It's going to niggle at you until you address it. And it's never too late, et cetera. So within the last couple months, my dream had been, because this is, I had the experience in my office 41 years ago. I had some outside consultants in. It was novel that people replay their family backgrounds wherever they go, and particularly in the work environment. And the extent that they're unconscious, they replay it, not only at work, but everywhere else in their lives. And then I ended up, I had trouble in my marriage. So I found this guy that had workshops. He said, how you replay your family background in your marriage, and you're going to marry someone that has the same traits, particularly the negative traits, as the people that raised you. Started to play golf, was playing tennis with a guy who's a shrink, psychiatrist. He wrote a book called How to Shrink Your Handicap. I get the book. It's how you replay your family background on the golf course, the people you pick, how you play out competition, how you handle a good shot, how you handle a bad shot. You know, I kept being exposed to systems like the 12 steps where there's resistance. And when I was in the insurance business, someone gave me a system, the art and science of building a life insurance clientele. And I was teaching people how to do that, a lot of resistance. So I was coaching a guy, and I've been promoting myself as a leadership life coach and business consultant, where I catalyze environments, allowing individuals and groups to naturally transform. My work is about actualism, transformation, and empowerment. So the truth is, I haven't had a business client, but I coached this guy. He referred me to a guy running a hedge fund here in the city. So the bottom line is, last week I met with him and his seven key people, and it went really well, and I'm meeting with them again tomorrow. And I even got a check. So I was telling my sponsee about this, and he said that he was in a meeting, another 12-step meeting, and there was a guy that was 79, and he shared, and he said that his life was so bright that he has to wear sunglasses and squint to even see the future. So I really got energized by this whole experience. And truth be told, I have no higher power was orchestrating every single interaction and move from way back when up until the last couple of weeks of working with his client and his key people. I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, it's one day at a time. I was ready to walk away from him a couple of times because he wanted to kept trying to negotiate my fee. And so then I'm brushing my teeth and it pops into my head that one of the consultants that taught me this process 41 years ago and worked in my office, I put his name in the internet, got his phone number. He's in Delray Beach. He's 80 years old. He retired at 60. He's been like a godsend to me, really offering me day-to-day advice and counsel, working me through this whole process of this system. And I know it's higher power. I mean, I spoke to him today and I record the conversations and then I walk around and meditate listening to the conversation, and which helps me get ready for the meetings. I will be married. I'm married 56 and a half years, one day at a time. I consider myself a very happily married man, but I'm not going to have you consult my wife on that. But this it's the best it's ever been. You know, that I mean, it's mostly program, but you know, we got married on the basis, I got married, like I said, 56 some years ago. We got married on the basis that she was going to quit smoking. Which how much I understand addiction. So she smoked for 50 years after we got married. I didn't know it in the beginning. And led me into Al-Anon and so on. And I, you know, so this whole notion that I can't fix, change, modify, alter, control another human being. And if it's about another person, there's no solution. And if I think you're my problem, I'm insane. Now, I certainly didn't come to that in any way, shape, or form by myself. I begin to learn. I forget a lot. I forget during the day, but I keep learning and program. So accepting her totally, completely, just exactly as she is, with no modifications required, with as much respect as I can bring. And I got married on the basis, you know, I was going to change a lot of, I was going to not only change the smoking, but I was going to change the rest of her so that I could be comfortable and not have to deal with this uncomfortable feelings. Because I'm finding, which maybe you have too, that everyone is my mirror. That if I'm having strong sensations or strong feelings as a result of an interaction, I may feel very self-righteous initially, but when I get away from it and start doing some of the spiritual work, I see that that person is representing character traits that I have that I either haven't accepted about myself, I'm in denial about myself, and I'm looking in the mirror and I can't stand it. So I judge them and get angry at them and resentful at them. And then I have to do the work. You know, I have to look at, well, you know, what's my part? How did I get the ball rolling? And invariably, I can always answer the question, you know, where was I inconsiderate? Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and so on? Invariably, those issues come up, particularly fear. And I'm learning that if I was a rageaholic coming from my family, can't remember the last time I did rage, which is a miracle, because I used to most days. And I'm learning to explore the fear in me rather than indulge the anger. That underneath my anger and rage is fear. And I had a therapist tell me that rage is an unmet childhood need. And I reconciled with my parents. My dad lived to almost 98, my mother almost 93. And thank God they lived long enough and I was in program long enough that somehow I got the ideal of my parents. I mean, as much as the kid in me wanted them to always say the magic words about how much they love me, et cetera, that never really happened. But what happened was I did some kind of a transformation where I said, okay, let me treat them the way I always wanted them to treat me without any need for anything in return. Now, that's a big statement, but over a period of time, I was able to do it. My dad had a stroke at 89. Like I said, he made it till 98. He wanted to go to 100. Tough guy. He was in hospice. They gave him like 48 hours. He lived for 6 or 7 days without food or water. Miraculous. So he had this stroke, and the whole left side was paralyzed. My first conversation with him on the phone, he was speaking complete gibberish. And I guess to him it made sense, but completely indistinguishable on my part. But to his credit, he got a speech therapist and got his speech back. And he had a pretty significant recovery, but never recovered totally from that stroke. And I remember him saying to me when I went to see him in Florida, he said, you know, I need you to be my eyes and ears now. And whatever resentments I had, they just completely vanished. And it, you know, I had a background in finance somewhat, so I handled all their finances and paid all their bills. And we did some estate planning and set up a trust. And I have two younger sisters, and it worked out very smoothly. And I was calling my dad almost every day, and I had my parents and whole family on the shelf for, I don't know, maybe a year or two when I was doing heavy duty therapy. I was just blaming them for everything. And I even learned that with the physical abuse of my dad, and maybe a little understanding of my own rage, that he would just lose control, and he was beating the demons out of himself. And sometimes the perpetrator suffers as much or more than the victim. And later in life, I knew that was true. I always had trouble totally and completely forgiving him. I had one beating when I was, 14, 15, maybe 14. And he was a very tough guy. He was literally a fullback and a linebacker in football. He was a naturally gifted athlete, a good looking guy, great dancer. And I was intimidated, especially, I was not a good dancer. I was just intimidated by it. And, you know, even my bar mitzvah, I remember I was one of the first bar mitzvahs that my friends, and you know, they always had these really big parties. So my dad had he had a party in the basement, and that night I'm walking downstairs to go to what I thought was the party. He had confronted me. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to the party." He said, "This is only for adults." So I didn't know that was kind of crazy. And it was about 30 years later, going to bar mitzvahs, I always felt uncomfortable and came up in therapy, and I started to get some understanding of it. I mentioned this thing when I was 14 or 15. I connected with kids, and I played a lot of sports, but I didn't like hang out much. But I was one of the rare times I was across the street hanging out with some kids in their basement. And my grandmother was, my father's mother was there, I guess, taking care of my two younger sisters. And we didn't have cell phones in those days. And I was not a hooligan. And I might be wrong, but I don't think I came home that late. Maybe it was after 11. And my dad was there, and his mother was worried. My grandmother was worried because she hadn't heard from me. And I came in, I was feeling really happy. I had a good time. And he just started wailing into me. And my mother, my two sisters, and my grandmother are standing at the bedroom door while I'm on the bed while he's doing this. And I must have been psychic somehow, because I had a baseball bat in my closet. And about 2 weeks before, I took it down in the basement and I hit it. And while he was going through this rage, I remember him stopping. He says, "You know, where's your effing baseball bat?" And he's rummaging through my closet. I always wondered, like, if he ever found that baseball bat, what would have happened to me? And I had handprints that were literally black and blue handprints on my body, and my face was all swollen in the morning. And he had a retail store, so in the morning he's taking me to the store. We stopped for breakfast, and the waitress said, "What happened to you?" So he interjects that I was in a Golden Gloves boxing tournament. The story I told my friends when they asked me what happened, because I was physically messed up, I would tell them that we were on a basketball court, and this bully was hassling us, and I tried to organize the guys to charge, and they didn't charge. I did. So I made up a lie. That was the story I told. But it was embarrassing. And even if I had a cell phone, and you know, in those days, would I have called the police? I don't know. I think I was too afraid. So I see 5 minutes. Thank you, Marlene. So I spoke to a co-sponsor in another program a little earlier, and I said, yeah, they asked me to speak for 45 minutes. He said, are you prepared? He said, did you take notes? I said, I don't know. My life is my preparation. And then I remember playing golf with my dad. These are all true stories. And I'm like getting ready to hit a shot. And he says, why don't you punch me in the mouth and get it over with? And I just totally froze. I just went on and continued to play golf. I'd never brought it up. I just froze. Another time we're talking on the phone. And I really did make an effort to try to do everything I could to let him and everybody else off the hook, that nobody owed me anything. I was no longer going to be resentful of anybody, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess the kid in me, you know, had trouble letting go. We're talking on the phone. This was maybe, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so before he passed. And he says, out of the blue, he said he thinks he wasn't a good father. And again, I froze. It would have been a great opportunity because he really did a lot. I'm learning, everybody's a mix. I got a lot of good stuff from my parents, and I got a lot of stuff that I had an opportunity to work on. Because you know, there are no perfect people. Maybe perfect. I consider myself to be both human and divine, and continue to work on the ideal to be the highest version of myself. And in program, that's what it's about. I remember going to an executive development program it was in the early 80s. And it was excellent. I was there for 3 weeks at Dartmouth. And we were doing this exercise. We were to come up with three things that were our primary quest. And most of the guys had wealth and power, things like that. And I don't remember the other two, but one that I did write down was, I can't think of the word. It was kind of something like, oh God, you guys would know the word, but it was something like self-evolvement, self-evolution. I didn't use enlightenment. But anyway, like after all the years afterwards, going to therapy, a lot of different spiritual programs, being an agnostic, being an atheist, doing these 12 steps. And then in 2006, which I never, ever, ever thought I would do, I ended up a prayer chaplain in a group, and I still am. Not ordained, but it's been absolutely wonderful. Where I pray with about the 12, 15 people a month that I call them, that they've requested prayer. And I feel this palpable energy often when I pray. And we were meeting in person, 1 minute. And we were meeting in person, we would hold hands at the facility, and people would stand in line, and there'd be about 10 prayer chaplains. And the training has been fantastic. I'm going up for a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday training that we do once a year coming up next month. And we meet once a month for training. And it's a very cohesive, about 30 of us. And it's just like program. All we do is work on ourselves, because that's when we're praying for someone, that's what we bring to the table. No more, no less. And I always wondered way back when why am I here? What's my purpose? I'm reading the big book, top of page 77. It says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people around us. So I didn't know what that meant, but fit ourselves, I guess, meant work the program, work the 12 steps. That's how we become fit to be of maximum service to God and the people around him. So, sponsoring people, doing coaching. Thank you for listening.